Welcome to episode 29 of The Joy of Writing. I'm your host, Mark Carew, author of three novels, and someone who is interested in how other writers write, why they do it, and the fun or joy they get from their writing. It's a pleasure to talk to Fiona Melrose, author of the novels Midwinter and Johannesburg. In this episode, we discuss Midwinter and how living in Suffolk, where the novel is set, inspired the story. Thank you very much for joining me on The Joy of Writing. I read your book, Midwinter, which is about a father and a son struggling to come to terms with the death of Cecilia, who's the mum. The father is Landin and the son is Vale. Tough subject matter, but a very enjoyable book, I found, reading it. And I wondered what was the urge or the spark to write that story?
Mark, hi, thanks for having me. I think it began, I was living in Suffolk at the time and I'd recently moved there. And there is something about moving to a new physical environment that I think makes you very sensitive to everything around you and gives you a very fresh perspective. And I was living on a farm and I found that all the Suffolk fellas that came to my door had a kind of awkwardness to them and a bit of charm.
Right.
And a reticence, and in a way that the women didn't. And I think what I found interesting was, what is it about being a man, being a farmer, what is it that makes things difficult for you, that makes them unable to chat or unable to express things? So it began as a kind of inquiry into, I guess, sort of masculinity as it was presenting itself to me in that environment, in that new environment. So, and I started with the father figure, Landin. He came to me first as one of these reticent, sort of slightly shuffling men at the kitchen door. And I took it from there. And then I thought, well, in a narrative sense and in life, what's it quite nice to give a father, an older man? Well, let's give him a son. Mm-hmm. and see how they play against each other, how their masculinity from different generations works together and against.
Yeah.
And I think that was the real start of that.
That's very interesting. They were indeed two awkward characters. I mean, Landin especially. And then Vale had some problems. And of course, part of the story is that he witnessed the aftermath of his mother's violent death. So I could see that. But they, and in a way, they're sort of joined by their grief. But it's something they don't talk about. And I did like the way that you referred in gradual sort of flashbacks to the scene in Zambia where Cecilia and Landin and Cecilia moved to start a new effort at farming, and you sort of cut back to that, making it even more interesting and terrible as we finally sort of see what had happened to Cecilia, perhaps through Vale's eyes and as well. How was that to write? Because again, that's tough. Tough scenes to manage.
I think violence in any form is quite hard to write. And initially, they were written. They occur, as you say, in the novel as segments through the length of the book. Initially, they were written as blocks, solid blocks. Chapters in their own right, but it didn't feel organic. Often, as for example, Landin and Vale are the ones having the flashback, and I sort of think, as reticent men who struggle with emotion, I don't think they would suddenly blurt out the whole story. I think they would release it in bite-sized chunks that they felt emotionally able to deal with, and so it would make sense for the reader to have access in that way. So that was the sort of reasoning behind that, I think. And I think also structurally, it made it too much a case of now we're in Suffolk, now we're in Zambia.
Yeah.
And it makes it a Zambian story, which I didn't want it to be. I wanted it to be a Suffolk story.
Right. So, I got that. I didn't think...
Sort of various reasons for it, but it is very difficult to write violence and to write upsetting scenes. But I suppose if you don't want to write upsetting scenes, then maybe you shouldn't write books.
Yeah.
That awful. I sort of think you need to go there or don't bother in a way.
And yeah. And I could see the way you handled it was you went there in small doses, like
yeah.
memories being retrieved and finally dealt with, but they can only be dealt with in small amounts. And it was very effective because I was always wondering, well, what exactly did happen here? It sounds bad. And then, of course, the central, perhaps, problem between Vale and Landin is that Vale blames Landin for what happened, which led to Landin hitting him. Because Vale eventually got to that stage where he goes, you know, Dad, she died because of you. And then, you know, he thumps him. And then they have to recover from that as well as the everything else.
It becomes layer upon layer of revisiting the initial trauma, but when it's not done appropriately, it becomes a re-traumatization in every way. Neither of them has the language for it, and that's, I think, a lot. It's also a lot about a lack of language and the difficulty. They literally don't have the words. They're reaching words the whole way through the novel and failing at every turn. They either lapse into silence, or they use aggressive words, or they use physicality or something. But there's the reaching towards language fails them at every turn. And I think that's the root of their trouble, which was a bit tricky to write because I kept having to restrain my writing, and I was having to sort of write with a handbrake up the whole time, because I couldn't just say, oh, and now this happens, because you have to sit in the room with that kind of tension and awkwardness with both of them. So, but then it becomes a novel of negative space in that way, that the silences speak for themselves and the absences, and that has to do a lot of the heavy lifting for the characters and the novel, I think.
And you say on your website, for example, that you enjoy getting into the skin of your characters, but you don't always think it's a very healthy thing to do.
No, it's not a very healthy thing to do. I remember they're so real to me.
Yeah.
They're so real to me. They become other people, which is something weirdly I deal with in my third book. But I remember going on this walk along what amounts to a hill in Suffolk. I suppose it's not. There's no such thing really as a hill in Suffolk. It may be the only one, yeah. And we called it Rabbit Hill. And I was walking along and I looked down and I saw this funny old Massey Ferguson chugging along, pulling a harrow behind. And I thought, oh, there's Vale and Tom. And I thought, God almighty, it's really not. You need to go to London and have a nice boozy night or something. You're too deep in this book. This is not healthy. I mean, I just saw, I thought, oh, there they are. Of course, that's where they are. So you need to, the separation becomes a bit tricky at some point. So
that's very funny. I mean, a lot of authors will say, first of all, that their characters will speak to them, and lots of people get quite upset by this. They think, well, are they mad? But that's not true. And then other authors will say, well, I've met my characters. And it sounds like, you know, you have that flash of recognition with two people, might be complete strangers, and you go, well, there are my characters right in front of me.
Yeah, absolutely that.
Right. I mean, a nice thing to do. When has it got really so unhealthy that you've thought, no, I've got to leave this. I mustn't get in their heads anymore. I must stop writing. Has that ever happened?
Yeah. I mean, book three was very difficult for me.
Uh-huh.
It's taken a while to write because it feels so immediate and so real, and the veil between worlds kind of drifting and slipping and permeable and being far too permeable.
Right.
In a way that becomes unmanageable, but the book deals with that. The book deals with with trying to, you know, the line between the a muse visitation, which is, you know, we can talk to Yeats or whatever, and what is actually basically unhealthy mental illness. You know, there becomes this line, but then also we name it different things in different times. What is considered something certifiable now, in another time would have been considered a visit, a shamanic vision, or a visit from the muse. And what is that line? How do we navigate it? And how do we name it and shame it? And that to me is interesting. It's something I like to interrogate, and that's basically what I've been doing with book three, is looking at that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And the names we attach to these things and different cultural aspects to it. And do we just medicate it away, or do we harness it, or what are we dealing with when we say that?
Yeah, different ways of looking at things, what do we call them? Like you're saying, you know, the veil between two worlds. Once upon a time, seances were the go-to party of the upper classes. Nowadays, it wouldn't be considered like that. But yeah, interesting. We'll talk about book three later on. Another thing I liked about Midwinter was some sort of mirroring and symbols that you've got going on. So you mentioned Vale and Tom in the field, and whenever anybody writes a character, a young lad called Tom, I always think of Tom Sawyer. So I was expecting Huck Finn to turn up, and these two were a little bit like that. Yeah. And then the book starts with a terrible accident, a boating accident. Very, again, violent stuff. Tom doesn't come out well from it. He's actually injured very, very badly, and he spends most of the book in hospital. And again, there's Vale has the guilt there for that. But what I liked about it was the mirroring, because Tom's father is an alcoholic, not a great dad. And that mirrors Vale and Landon's problems as well. But in a way, it's a sort of a proxy where they can kind of start helping each other out.
Very much. I think. Sorry to interrupt. I think Landon becomes a father figure for Tom.
Right.
In a way Tom really appreciates, and yet the same attention he gives to Vale is pushed away, and in some ways he speaks to Tom in a way he can't speak to his own son. So they all have these, as you say, proxy relationships with other people that circle around and around, and I find it interesting how people, we all do that, we all have this messiness in our lives which is so unnecessary. It's interesting you talk about mirrors. As you said that, I suddenly thought, well, one of the most important mirrors for me in the book is the one between Vale and Chisongo, who's the young man in Zambia. Uh-huh. When we meet them, I mean, it's years apart in the timeline, but when we meet them, they're the same age. They both work as farm laborers. They both are what we would call angry young men with unresolved things in their past that we don't really understand. They've both fallen in with a sort of rough crew. They could really do better in their choice of friends, and both make very poor decisions. And Chisongo comes out of it much worse than Vale does, but Vale could have gone the same way. He could also landed up in court staring down a prison sentence if perhaps Tom had died or something had happened. And it was interesting to me and important to me to kind of mirror their lives quite closely, so that we look at Chisongo and we say, well, here's a young man who went the same way as Vale, but it ended up so differently. And there's such a fine line between surviving that kind of chaos in your life and not, and things getting much, much worse. And there are moments, tiny choices, it almost seems, for each that could have gone differently. So that's another mirror that is quite important to me. And I wanted to set it in Zambia so that it was a personal story. It wasn't a political story, because I think if I'd chosen Zimbabwe or South Africa, it would have landed up being a political story.
Right.
Whereas Zambia is more neutral, and then we can focus on Chisongo as a young man, like Vale.
That really came through in the book, the way... they looked out at other people to try and help them to deal with their own. So it was a very circuitous journey coming round finally to confronting the problems that they had with one another, Vale and Landon. I thought it was really, really nicely done. I like, for example, you had a character, a farmer called Dobler.
Yeah.
who was a good old boy. He was a voice of reason and obviously quite a character. That was one of the most sort of, uplifting parts of the book, where you met this man who knew everything about pigs. And, I did enjoy the scene where you had to get the pigs in the trailer. and Vale and Landon were trying to do this, but Vale actually went off in a huff afterwards. But it was all about turnips in the straw, and I thought this is fun, you know. This
yeah.
is good. How, and again, it's all male. It's male relationships.
Yeah.
But there, Landon had a good male relationship with Dobler, and Dobler was like, you know, definitely the voice of reason, trying to help him along a bit. That was good. Another nice relationship, which sadly didn't go brilliantly well, but not awfully bad, was Vale taking a fancy to Beth, who serves in the pub. And they eventually get to go out for a walk, although he pulls out at the last minute, which was a shame. But then Beth, of course, was another symbol for, I think, Cecilia, a mother figure. And they shared red hair. And also then, of course, the most obvious symbol, which Landon held on to, was the arrival every now and then of the red vixen. So I think were there foxes around in the countryside? They were a big obvious part of it.
Yeah, I mean, when I went to Suffolk, I couldn't stand the sort of calls of the foxes at night. I found them so unsettling, really unsettling and spooky, and it really kind of cuts across the land. And they were always, I felt like they was watching me more than I was watching them. I felt incredibly haunted by them. And this novel started as a short story about a fox, and then became a novel from that story called, rather imaginatively, The Fox.
Okay.
So it sort of began with the fox and this kind of incredible haunting, and I think much of my arrival in Suffolk was quite, you know, I think I had a kind of a sort of Beatrix Potter vision of twittering hedgerows and bunnies in jackets and whatnot, but it was actually quite a much more visceral experience than I ever could have imagined. It was, you know, sort of rabbits with myxomatosis keeling over in front of you, and foxes and badgers, and it was really, and crows ripping things apart, and it was just, I think I sort of, this slightly more gothic side of me responded to that and really accessed it very readily. So the fox was an early addition to the novel. It was always going to, it started with the fox probably before even the menfolk. And then she became this sort of, I think she becomes the feminine aspect of the novel.
Yes. Yeah.
In the sense that I've had people say, oh, there are no girls in this book, or there are very few girls. And I'm like, no, they're all there, but they're just in the background or not mentioned. There's Dobler's wife, Dobler's daughter making jam and all sorts of things. But they're kind of peripheral to this, and they're not really given access.
They didn't feature too highly. I mean, of course, we got flashbacks to Cecilia. And a bit of Beth in the pub, and the vixen came every now and then, kind of giving Landon hope in a way. I know he was really projecting into that animal. And Vale immediately said, you know, that's not her, that's not Mum. Which was interesting. Just to stick with the animal theme, there was a dog, Pup, who was Landon's dog, who got very unwell, end of life stuff. And really struggling, and the kindest thing was to phone the vet to ask to, you know, put it down. But that wasn't possible. The vet was away. They were going to have to deal with it themselves. And Landon couldn't do it. It fell to Vale to take care of the situation. And the scene that follows, I thought, was very well written. But it's talk about getting in the heads of your characters, because it was, you know, it was a violent end for Pup. How did you feel about that? Because I believe you're a dog lover, and this wouldn't be a gratuitously fun thing to write about.
It was awful. I think I thought, I mean, it was organic to the story. It wasn't a sort of, I hope it wasn't gratuitous. But there is also a tradition in novels of young men of a sort of coming of age from boy to man killing something.
Yep.
I mean, there is that kind of trajectory in Buildings from Man. Often in American novels, they land up sort of doing something dreadful. So there is that tradition, that literary tradition. also, I think I thought, well, what would be the most awful thing for me? I think
right.
So. It was also that what yeah. would be absolutely impossible,
mm-hmm.
but something necessary for me to have to do, and that is the most obvious thing. And this little dog has been its own character in
yes.
the novel anyway. So, and it also then became a kind of generational gesture between Vale and his dad being the one to kill his beloved dog, who Vale slightly resents the tenderness,
yeah.
intimacy that his father has with this dog, and then Vale can't even have a normal conversation with him. So it became a kind of it became a very important scene in the book. It became kind of pivotal on multiple levels.
Yes.
Then in terms of writing it, I think we could learn a lot from the Russians, in the sense that I noticed reading Russian short stories is before they sort of do something awful, and there's a lot of, you know, abjectly awful stuff in Russian short stories. There's always a sort of massacre or a goose about to have its throat slit or something. You know, there's always something bad about to happen. And what I've noticed often happens is they slow down the language and precede the violence with a scene of incredible stillness and beauty.
Okay.
And what that does is it then escalates the violence. It feels that much worse.
Yeah.
Because the truth is, you can't just write violence in a sustained kind of hyperbolic manner. It won't work. It
no.
feels forced and it feels awkward. So I took a little cheeky cheat out of the Russians book, which is not the worst place to cheat. And I tried to really slow things down and concentrate on the drift of the snow and the quiet
yeah.
moment, and then have the escalation of the killing of the dog. And I don't know if it worked. I hope it worked, but it does sort of emphasize the difference between the stillness and the violence.
Absolutely.
And it's a cheap trick. Everyone can try it.
Well, it was like dynamics in music, or it's the lull before the final battle, isn't it? You know, the soldiers
yeah.
are waiting and it's all quiet and they have a few moments of peace before it all kicks off. There was some sort of redemption at the end of the story, which I thought was a very nice way to round it all up, with the offer that Tom, who really does not want to have to return home to his dad, Vale and Landon offer Tom, you know, to come and live with us, which suited sort of both of them, suited all three of them, really. Landon finds it easier with Tom, but he made up in the end with Vale. In a very touching scene where they sort of just, you know, lie on a bed together. So that was a very, yeah, very nice way of sort of getting through all the major story strands and tying them up. Was my overall question was, what was the most satisfying or enjoyable thing for you to have written in the book? I mean, what bits sort of came out just as you want it, or were there any new bits that just surprised you and you were very pleased with?
I mean, honestly, with your first novel, I think you're just delighted to get to the end. I think the sheer surprise that you
Quite
can
right.
actually write. I mean, I think that maybe yeah. a novelist, what you're doing is working out if you can actually write a novel. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think there is, apart from that overwhelmingly obvious joy of
yeah.
Managing to get to the end, I think I loved writing, and I still do, I loved writing descriptions of the natural world and
uh-huh.
and that kind of immersion in a landscape. I find that even now incredibly satisfying. It's something I respond to naturally. It's where my instincts go as a writer. So I think that there's always a kind of a joy in that and a kind of elation
yeah.
in those kinds of passages.
I know what you mean, especially with the countryside, because you wonder as the world changes that the countryside might be lost or or it will disappear and change in a way that it was never quite as lovely as you remember it, you know, on that any given moment. So there's almost a need to capture what it looks like.
I'm also very weary of romanticizing and I find nostalgia quite a dangerous
mm-hmm.
concept in many ways. So to also show that the extraordinary beauty of it, but also show its mucky underbelly, because
right.
at the same time these are there's poverty. I mean, if you
yeah.
land and Bell, and one of the great themes of the novel is poverty and this constant
yeah.
struggle to simply survive, and how many times they nearly lost the farm or did lose
yeah.
the farm and they got it back, and And that's generational. You get the sense that Tom and Vale are going to continue to struggle, and you've got other smaller characters like Mole Boy who,
you
get
fun.
Their mole business going, and you think, oh God, is he going to make it? You know, you sort of worry for these young men on a basic financial level. So, so which I hope acts as a bit of a balance for the kind of hopefully not indulgent nature writing.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, the countryside is beautiful, but farming, for example, such a tough business. Would test anyone. Thank you, Fiona. I really enjoyed talking about the book and look forward to talking to you again. In the next episode, I will be talking with Fiona again about writing books 3 and 4, what being a writer means to her, and how she approaches the task of teaching creative writing.